Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 12 through 15. Observe the Sabbath by keeping it holy, as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but on the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns, so that your male and female servants may rest as you do. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. In Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 17 through 22. Do not deprive the foreigner or the fatherless of justice, or take the cloak of the widow as a pledge. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. That is why I command you to do this. When you are harvesting in your field, and you overlook a sheaf, do not go back to get it. Leave it for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat the olives from your trees, do not go over the branches a second time. Leave what remains for the foreigner and the fatherless and the widow. When you harvest the grapes in your vineyard, do not go over the vines again. Leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. That is why I command you to do this.
Good morning, Midway Mennonite. It's great to be with you, be back with you this week after being gone last week. And I know we have a number of visitors here for Paul and Ruth's 70th anniversary celebration, so I want to welcome you and anybody else who's joining us today. Just I want to welcome you, say we're glad to have you. So the last place my grandma and grandpa Cutchell, my mom's dad and mom lived, was this retirement village in Arkansas called Bella Vista. And this was a little bit like our Sarasota of the Midwest. There was golf courses, there was all kinds of things catered towards folks who had retired. And one of the things my grandpa loved to do was take me up to his dining area. See, my grandpa loved buffets. Yeah, some of you love buffets. And so when he moved up to this retirement community, he had access to buffets 3 times a day. So 3 times a day, he could eat as much as he wanted. And he would, when he would take me up there, he would usually say something like this: Matt, you can eat all you want. You can go up as many times as you want. There's chicken, there's potatoes, there's soup, there's dessert. You go up 1, 2, 3, 4 times. It doesn't matter. You go up as many times as you want. Because he just thought this was great. And as I, my grandpa's no longer alive, as I've reflected this and tried to figure out, you know, what was so amazing about that to him, I don't know the answer, but I think some of it has to go back to his childhood growing up in the Great Depression. And my theory is that all these years later, 70 years later, there was still something amazing about the concept of an all-you-can-eat buffet. And it wasn't just that grandpa, it was every one of my grandparents, I think. The Great Depression worked its way out in their life in some way. Memory and story worked through their habits and their values and all these things in their life. That memory and story of the Great Depression worked its way out. And when my grandpa would say, look at this buffet, look at how you can eat all you want, behind that was a memory of scarcity, of struggle, of deprivation. But here's the deal, that's not what I saw in that buffet. For me, that scene of abundance was just another scene of abundance after another scene of abundance after another scene of abundance. The closest thing I remember to being that excited was when McDonald's allowed you to get free refills. Yes, same age. I was just blown away by that because you used to get your small cup and then all of a sudden you can get as much soda as you possibly want. And it was an overwhelming feeling as a kid, but it's not quite the same. And see, the challenge my grandpa had was, how do you then pass on that story, that memory? How do you communicate how amazing an all-you-can-eat buffet is when it elicits little more than a yawn in your grandson? So we're in a series, if you're just joining us here, we're in an eight-week series on Sabbath. We're in the seventh week of Sabbath, and we're looking at this ancient gift, this ancient commandment, and this ancient practice of ceasing, of resting. And this morning, I want to talk about this connection between Sabbath and memory, Sabbath and story. And the reason I tell you this story about my grandpa is because, in many ways, this is the challenge that Moses faces in the book of Deuteronomy. So by the time we get to the book of Deuteronomy, and I've told this before, but I'll just remind you, we're just east of the Jordan River, just about to cross into Canaan, the promised land. And the Israelites have now been wandering about 40 years. It's been 38 years since they received the Sinai covenant. And Moses is, this book consists of this series of farewell speeches by Moses. Because if you remember, this is the end of the line for Moses. He's not crossing over that Jordan River. And in fact, it's actually that whole Exodus generation is all pretty much gone. Because according to Scripture, there's only two people that were allowed from that generation to enter the Promised Land, and that was Caleb and Joshua. And so Moses, this is the end. He's got these speeches to tell these people as they're about to cross the Jordan into the Promised Land. And he says, "Remember when you were slaves in Egypt." Now that's interesting because he's telling people to remember being slaves who never experienced slavery, who would have no memory, at least of themselves, of slavery. This wasn't their story. This was the story of their parents and their grandparents and their great-grandparents. But in this book, Moses is trying to make the case, this actually isn't just their story, this is your story. And I want you to look at how he starts right before the Ten Commandments. So there's two places the Ten Commandments are given, once in Exodus at Mount Sinai, and once now here in Deuteronomy before they cross over. Larry, could you put the first slide up? And this is the preface to those Ten Commandments. Moses convened all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and ordinances that I am addressing to you today. You shall learn them and observe them diligently. The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb," so Mount Sinai, "not with our ancestors," particularly this last line I want you to notice, "not with our ancestors did the Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today." Thanks, Larry. So he's saying this covenant wasn't just with your ancestors. You weren't there, or almost all of you weren't there at Mount Sinai when this covenant was given. And yet, this covenant applies to you. And because this is your covenant, you inherit both the responsibilities of this covenant and the gift of this covenant, which is the land. And time again in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses is going to keep saying this word, remember. Remember, remember, remember. Could you go up to the next slide, Larry? This kind of sums it up well towards the end. Remember the days of old. Consider the generations long past. Ask your father and he will tell you, your elders, and they will explain to you. So again, remember, remember the days of old. Ask your father. If you don't remember, ask your father. Ask the elders. See, I think one of the biggest reasons, there's a lot of reasons why Moses wants to tell us, but I think one of the biggest reasons is prosperity has a tendency to breed amnesia. Let me say that again. Prosperity has a tendency to make people forget things. Forget where they came from, forget how they got there. And they have this feeling that all this prosperity that they might have now actually was a result of their own work. And Moses is very aware of this. This is why, next slide. I want you to look at this slide. When the Lord your God, so Moses is looking ahead and he said, you're going to be in that promised land soon. And this is what I want to give you a warning about. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you swore to his fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, a land with large, flourishing cities you did not build, houses with all kinds of good things you did not provide, wells you did not dig, and vineyards and olive groves you did not plant. Then when you eat and are satisfied, be careful that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. So Moses is saying, you're going to get to this promised land and you're going to find a lot of good things. Your homes are going to be stuffed with good things, but be careful. Because prosperity has a tendency to make you forget the past, forget where you came from. And you'll start to think, well, these cities are flourishing because we built them. And these houses are filled with good things because, well, we earned those good things. And these vineyards produce good fruit because we planted those grapes. And you will sit back with your belly full and self-satisfied and say, look at all I have done. Look at all I've accomplished. And Moses says, be careful. See, if you're not careful, all that satisfaction is going to make you forget the Lord. The one who brought you out of Egypt, the one who delivered you from slavery, and the one who gave you this land. See, you're going to start thinking that everything that you have here is a result of your own work, and you're going to forget the one who made it possible, the Lord your God. So why does Moses care so much about remembering? So we've got Moses giving these speeches, and he's trying to tell them you got to remember. Why? Well, what happens if you forget? I'm a little bit nervous about telling this now, because now we actually have a real Illinois farmer here that I didn't realize was going to be here today, but he can correct me after the service if I'm wrong. But okay, here's my experience, my limited experience farming in Illinois for 8 years, is that often there was these family farms where you had three generations. You had someone my age, then you had their father, who would have been my parents' age, you know, 60s or 70s. And then sometimes you still had the next generation. And I love that because a lot of times that was the one driving the grain carts around. And some of those older men and women never wanted to stop. They never wanted to stop farming. I love that. They would often be still in harvest time and stuff, still working. But there's these three generations. And each of them were informed by the past. So I heard lots of stories from that second generation that would be my parents' age. I heard about the farm crisis in the 1980s. And the stories I would hear about were when hog prices dropped so much, it wasn't even worth taking the hogs to the butcher. And people would actually, like, I heard stories of people coming with their cars and, like, putting a hog in a car because they just were just basically giving them away, where the farm would go to the grocery store and that ham in the grocery store cost more than their entire hog. And these farmers who had hogs in the 80s, they never forgot this. They never forgot what happened, if they survived. So, but the next generation, that my grandparents' generation, obviously they experienced that, remember, but they were informed by the Great Depression. You know, that was the time where, right before the Great Depression, a lot of people were able to acquire a lot of land and machinery because they secured that with their assets of their farm. Because at that time, land values were high and crop prices were high. The stock market then crashes. Land values plummet. Banks have to foreclose on the farms, and families are thrown off of some of those farms. And I always, you know, it takes a lot of money in many ways to farm in the Midwest today. When you're farming 2,000 or 3,000 acres, you've got combines and pickers and machinery that's worth millions and millions of dollars. And I always got the sense that it made them just a little bit nervous how much debt you had to have to be a farmer today. You know, I think they worked with it, but I think that always made, because they were informed by that memory of when people lost their farms. Because you see, I think we all know history has a way of repeating itself. And that's what Moses is concerned about. Let's go to the next slide. Slide number 4. You shall not deprive a resident alien or an orphan of justice. You shall not take a widow's garment in pledge. Remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I command you to do this. And then Deuteronomy 10, 17 through 19. For the Lord your God is a God of gods and the Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow, and loves the foreigner residing among you, giving them food and clothing. And you are to love those who are foreigners, for you yourselves were foreigners in Egypt. So one of the things that Moses is afraid of, one of the reasons why he has to keep saying, remember, 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 is that he's afraid that once they get to the promised land, they're going to forget that they were once strangers, that they once spent 400 years as slaves in Egypt. And then if they forget that, they're more likely to do the same thing, to deprive the alien and the orphan and the widow of justice. And so Moses says, you have to love the stranger because you have to remember that you were once the stranger. So the memory of slavery has these consequences if you forget it. Okay, next slide. Okay, I've showed this one the first week, but I want to show it again. Because again, there's two places the Ten Commandments are, and they're rooted in different things. Exodus, remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. So again, the Exodus command is rooted in imitating God. God rested, therefore we're to rest. But Deuteronomy is different. It's almost exactly the same command except for this. Observe the Sabbath. So notice that. I pointed that out earlier. It's not remember, but observe. Observe the Sabbath by keeping it holy. Remember that you were once slaves in Egypt. Sorry, there's a typo. And that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. So look at the difference here. The command in Deuteronomy is observe something so that you'll remember it. In other words, you need to do something so you don't forget it. And what you're doing is keeping the Sabbath. And if you keep the Sabbath, you should remember two things. One, it's God that freed you. It's God that got you out of slavery. And two, you need to provide rest for those around you. And we have this kind of like, what I'd like you to think about this is kind of this concentric circle. So in that passage that Lucy read, we start out with like, you need to rest. Like you're the one with the most power and the most privilege. Like you have to rest. And the reason is because so your son and daughter can rest. So you're right at the center. You're the one with the power. You need to rest so your son and daughter can rest. And then after your son and daughter is the maidservant and the manservant. So we're kind of extending out. We're getting a little bit farther away from that core. And he's saying, you need to rest so they can rest. And finally, he goes out to the alien within the gate. And this is the farthest out here. And he's saying, you need to rest so that they can rest. And we see God's like long arms of embrace that's pulling in the people that are on the most fringe of society. And the reason Moses says this is because that was once where you were. You were once on the edge of that circle. And so the Sabbath is a day in sense of imagination. Because again, these people don't remember this. And Moses is saying, take this day and imagine. Stop and remember and imagine what it would have been like to be in your ancestors' shoes in slavery. Put those shoes on, walk around them for a little bit, and hopefully you'll gain some empathy. Because we tend to have empathy when we see ourselves in a story, when somebody else's story reminds us of our own story. So, let me just say, last year, some of you who were on the search committee might remember, in between talking to the search committee and coming here, I actually got a chance to go to Norway to visit my best friend who married a Norwegian from college. And Norway is, if you've been there or you've seen pictures, is a spectacular country. I think it might be the most beautiful country in the world. No offense to Switzerland. I think Norway's spectacular. It's almost entirely covered in mountains, and it has these fjords. So these inlets of water that come into the mainland, and then you have got these dramatic cliffs that drop down thousands of feet, and it's just spectacular. And up on these cliffs, what I noticed is that there's these little farms, you know, farms maybe half the size of the sanctuary. And what I found out was that people would actually hike up to these mountains, and these cliffs, and farm this ground because farmland was so scarce in Norway. In Norway, it was a tough place to farm. Tough climate, tough terrain, and farm ground was really scarce. And then things got even harder in 1845 when a potato blight hit Norway. And that's when my ancestors, on my dad's side, began to migrate from Norway to the United States. And while when I returned to Norway, it is now one of the most prosperous countries in the world, but my ancestors would have left a country. I joined 800,000 people in 100 years that left behind one of the poorest countries in Europe. So they would have left behind starvation. They would have left behind little job opportunity. They would have left behind almost no social mobility. And they would have left behind a life that was hard. And those ancestors settled in Yankton County in southeast South Dakota. And I've also gotten a chance to go to my home place or a family in Yankton County. And one of the amazing things is if you contrast that scene I told you in Norway with Yankton County, you stand on the ground in Yankton County and you see as far as you can see the prairie. You see deep, rich, fertile soil. And when my ancestors came here, they settled on that and they began to farm that ground. And life didn't get easy too fast. It actually was pretty hard with poverty and hunger and homesickness. Kind of the definitive account of my people is a book called Giants in the Earth, and it's of Norwegian immigrants. And one of the scenes I'll never forget is the wife looking out on this prairie and just weeping. And not because of joy, because she was so lonely and missed the home country so bad, the beauty of Norway, as she looked at these vast plains of South Dakota. And the reason I know this story is because it was passed on to me by my grandparents. And as I thought about it, they passed on to me in two ways, food and jokes. So my grandma today still makes Norwegian flatbread. And flatbread is, if you ever had it, a lot of times you spread butter on it. It's unleavened bread. And I always enjoyed it as a kid. I thought it was good. She also made lefse. Sometimes people are more familiar with lefse, which is made out of potatoes. But there's actually a story behind that bread. So that flatbread is, when they migrated from Norway to here, they would make up big containers of flatbread, and they would store it on the boats because it didn't mold. And that was, in a sense, their exile food. This was their manna for the trip from Norway to the United States. Because it didn't mold, it lasted, and that's how they survived. And the other way that was passed on was jokes. So if you've ever been to the upper Midwest, Scandinavians love to tell jokes, kind of self-deprecating jokes about Ole and Lena and Ole and Sven. And is Lana here, Van Pelt? Oh, man, Lana's not here. So when I first got here, she's here. Okay, Lana, Lana said to me, Pastor Walt, he told jokes. And I said, Lana, I don't really tell jokes in my sermon. But I'm going to make an exception for you, Lana, today. I'm going to tell you an Ole and Sven joke. So Ole and Sven are these Norwegian farmers, okay? And they don't usually come out looking very smart in these jokes, but Sven's out in the outhouse, and Ole goes up, and he sees that Sven's is throwing money down the hole in the outhouse. And Ole says to Sven, "Oofdas, Sven, what you doing, fella? Why you throwing these $5 and these $10 bills down the hole? What you doing, fella?" And Sven says, "Well, when I was pulling up my trousers, a nickel fell in there. And I'm not going down in that mess just to get a nickel." So these self-deprecating jokes that my grandpa told were funny, but there was actually a story behind them. There was a story about immigrants who struggled with the English language. And that's why they often have such a thick accent in these jokes. They were Norwegians who were struggling with a new culture. And they told jokes as kind of this solidarity to kind of jest about their immigrant experience. So this is my story. And what's really been great about being with you guys is so many of you know your stories. You care about your stories. And you have some amazing stories. You have stories of hardship. You have stories of fleeing religious persecution. You have stories of exile. Stories which have been passed down generation after generation. And just like Moses and that generation who's about to cross the Jordan, when we hear these stories of our migrant parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, it pushes us to see something of ourselves in immigrants today. And it pushes us to think that if we forget these stories, if we forget where we were once, we're more likely to forget the alien within the gate today. You see, prosperity has a way of breeding amnesia, and amnesia has a way of breeding mistreatment. And Moses knew this. And each of us carries that story of our past in our bones and in our heads, a story who tells us who we are and where we came from and how we are to live now. And that, in many ways, is the story of this country. But that's not really our story, at least not our ultimate story. Because as much as I care about my Norwegian ancestors, as much as I think it matters to know where we came from, those stories have a tendency to stop. They have a tendency to reach a premature conclusion. They have a tendency to cross the waters, the exile, into the promised land where we carve out a new life in the new world, and then we are no longer migrants or aliens or foreigners, but citizens, permanent residents. But is that who we really are? Not according to the Apostle Paul. Because according to the Apostle Paul, our citizenship is not actually here. Our citizenship is in heaven. And if my citizenship is not here but in heaven, that means I have a whole lot more in common with my migrant brother and sister in Christ than I ever imagined. That means we're actually part of the same story, a story of Christ crucified. And if we're part of the same people, the people of Christ, the church, we answer to the same King, King Jesus. And we are headed in the same direction, migrants on our way to the new Jerusalem. See, that's my ultimate story, and that is your ultimate story at Children of God. It's an old, old story of unseen things above, of Jesus and his glory, of Jesus and his love. And that is the story that we need to keep coming back to again and again and again, because we have to anchor ourselves in that story. If we don't find our ultimate identity in that story, if we don't find ourselves in that story, our culture will be glad to give us a different story. Our culture will be glad to give us a different identity, and our culture will be glad to give us a different Lord. And this is something Anabaptists have long understood. And we can have good discussions about how much we should engage in civics and politics and everything. But Anabaptists have always been leery of engaging too much with politics. And part of that reason is because whether it's the political left or the political right, they don't tell our story. They do not tell our story. They can't possibly tell our story because our story as Christians is too crazy, it's too weird, and it's too dangerous for any political party to tell or to live out. It is the story of a creator God, an all-powerful, all-knowing God who came to his people in the form of a child, the form of a slave, humbling himself, becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And in that story, we are told we're supposed to find our path and our attitude in following that story. And this is a crazy story. And if we really strive to live out this story, we are always going to feel like aliens in this country. It's not that we don't find some rest or we don't have anything in common, but we're always going to feel like migrants and aliens because we're told to live out the story that is really strange. And in order to keep that story in our minds, we have to keep telling it again and again. That's why Moses established this day for the Israelites. He said, if you don't establish a day to tell the story, you're going to forget it. Because it's a crazy, unlikely story about you being freed from slavery. And the reason why we are gathered here this morning and why we gather each Lord's Day is to hear that story. We hear that story in word, we hear the story in song, and we hear that story in bread and wine, just like I heard the story of my ancestors through flatbread. This is an old, old story. It's a story about how we were once enslaved to sin and dark powers, but that a new Moses, Jesus Christ, came and rescued us, redeemed us, and made his people citizens of heaven.